The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:40 in the afternoon of Friday, May the 4th, 2007. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Terrio is here, Senator Welikowski, myself, Senator French. We are here on four bills this afternoon, and let's begin with a new CS for House Bill number 19, Judiciary. The backslash and working document is R. Romeo, if that could be moved.
I would move the backslash R version as the working document before the committee.
And we have the initial bill sponsor with us, Mr. His representative, Mr. Pawlowski. Mr. Pawlowski, if you put yourself on the record and lead us through the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. First, I'd like to, I was asked to express the sponsor's appreciation that the way the two proposals merge together, we think, creates a more comprehensive program and really gets at the issues. The pieces of the legislation that are intact from House Bill 19 are really found in Section 1, which is sort of the cleanup language related to ignition interlock devices and the tampering statutes. Section 3 is conforming language for, I believe that's limited license.
I believe that's correct.
Section 4, I believe that came from your bill, actually. That's conforming language.
Actually, hold on 1 second. I believe Section 4 is the one strike and you're out provision we discussed for limited licenses. Is that? And let me just explain to the members of the committee and the public, the just as an overview, we've taken the limited license ignition interlock bill and inserted the ignition interlock bill that I had been working on to make one comprehensive program. The limited license interlock is available on your first, second DWI, or third even. As long as you haven't ever violated the terms of that limited license, and that's what Section 4 does. It says if you've ever violated the terms of that limited license, you're done with a limited license, and we're not going to try you again on that. So that's what Section 4 does. The remaining sections, in essence, deal with ignition interlocks not during your limited license period, but during the period of your probation for having been convicted of DWI. And we'd experimented earlier with a total requirement of an interlock during that period, but we've fallen back to something I think a little more reasonable and a little more workable, which is a year of an interlock for your first conviction, 2 years on your second, 3 years on your third, and then throughout the period of your probation after that. Finally, we've adopted a uniform sort of standard for where and when ignition interlocks are used, and that is basically tracks the insurance requirement. That is, if you have to have a mandatory insurance, you have to have an interlock. If you don't, you don't. And forgive me for having jumped in, Mr. Pawlowski, but I think that...
Not at all, Mr. Chairman. Those are the changes, and I just say for the record that the sponsor believes that your interpretation of how to deal with the smaller communities and the insurance exemption probably is a more workable way to get around it and will lead to a more predictable outcome.
And
as opposed to leaving it up to the courts, which we had done. Yeah.
And let me just say back, it was a pleasure to work with you and your boss, Representative Meyer. I think we do have, in essence, this is a bold new experiment in DWI prosecution. This is going to require ignition interlocks for every single person convicted of DWI. I want to thank Senator Welikowski for being a pusher on that idea. Seems to be working in New Mexico. Alaska's had a long and tragic history, as we all know, with DWI, and there doesn't seem to be any downside to giving this a go. If it doesn't work, we'll come back and look at it, but my view is it needs to be tried.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might just add that the durations and lengths that you've put in your bill related to probation correspond very well with the Department of Public Safety's letter that talks about the amazing gains in recidivism in neighboring Canadian provinces that have a similar thing, which is in the neighborhood of 80+%.
So we're hopeful. We're all cautiously optimistic. We're all hopeful. Senator Terrio.
Recidivism of 80% or 80% of the people?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, for the record, it was 80% of the people, they see a decrease in recidivism.
Yeah. Further questions or comments for the bill's sponsor or for the front half of the bill, if you will, or for me for the back half?
What have we done on the fiscal impact? What's...
The That's a good question. Initially, did your bill have a fiscal note?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, House Bill 19 did carry a fiscal note. You'll see it's from administration, and it's particularly related to the Department of Motor Vehicles producing a new license and what goes along with that. And those are DMV receipts. It's $76,000 in the first year. Largest component of that, personal services, the second largest being contractual. And that's the programming that needs to be done for the Department of Motor Vehicles database. That drops off in the first year, and it runs along at just about $59,000 a year. And it is supported and paid for by the application fees.
There is one amendment to the bill. It's, we'll style it amendment number one. It's should be on your desks. It's /R.1. I'll move the amendment and then object to it for the purposes of discussion. If you'll flip over to page 3, line 6, the issue is taking care of conforming language to the areas of the state where you must apply for a limited license and what happens when you do apply, and by inserting the words when applicable after the word and on line 6 would make it clear that you only have to let me make sure I understand, get the you only have to do this when you're on the road system and not when you're off the road system, and I'm using road system as a proxy for where you have to have mandatory insurance, where you have to have the interlocks. So if you don't have to have the interlock, then you don't have to comply with this section. Questions?
I didn't follow that at all. Go back. So if I get busted for DWI, I'm going to have to have an interlock. Can I move to a community that doesn't require, and then I don't have to have the interlock?
No.
I was going to say, Senator Terrio, through the chair, the key being on page 3, line 4, whenever the person operates a motor vehicle in a community.
Yeah, the geographic restriction. You can't avoid the imposition of an interlock. You can't avoid it by moving to a small community and staying there. That is, while you're operating your vehicle on those roads where you don't have to have insurance, you don't have to have an interlock, but you can't avoid it by, say, getting a post office box in that community and claiming to be from that area, and then registering your vehicle there and then not getting an interlock. Further questions or comments, Mr. Pulowski?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say, it really is just a drafting problem, that it would require somebody living in a small community where they don't have to have an ignition interlock to provide proof that they have one. So it, when applicable, just cleans up the language.
I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number one. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. That brings the bill back before us. The don't know if there's anything else to cover while the bill is here. I'll just point out that the bill takes effect January 1, 2008 to give the world some time to catch up on this. So it's not going to go into effect this summer. It'll go into effect next year. Further discussion on the bill? Ready for a motion?
Yep. Mr. Chair, I would move that we move Senate CS for CS House Bill number 19 Judiciary to the next committee of referral with accompanying fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. We'll take a recess for the paperwork. The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Next up is Senate Bill 145 by Senator McGuire. The version, let me see, I had a, here we go. The bill sponsor is unable to be here today. In discussions with the Department of Labor and the municipality, it was decided to drop the language regarding accessing the Department of Labor's records. And that was section one of the bill. It's now gone. Section one is the original section. This returns the bill to us in its original form, which is backslash A. And copies have been distributed. Everyone should have copies of that. Making the change eliminates the fiscal note from the Department of Labor. We've talked to the department and received this assurance from them. I believe the representatives were outside the room just a few minutes ago, actually still standing in the doorway. And so I'd entertain a motion to backslash to adopt backslash A.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
The bill is before us. As you'll see now, the bill simply allows municipalities to provide for the impoundment or forfeiture of a motor vehicle used by a person who has $1,000 or more delinquent traffic fines for violations committed within the municipality. It would then put the car in a place where it can be held until the fines are satisfied and then returned to the owner. It's just a mechanism to put some downward pressure on the scofflaws that we saw listed in the handout earlier. At the bill's earlier hearing, and thus we hope collect more money from the unpaid fines and take care of the problem that way. Other further questions, comments, or debate about the bill?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good bill, and I am glad to see that we removed that other provision. I had a lot of concerns over that provision. I don't know that it really complied with the mission of the Department of Labor. So I'm glad to see we're back to this, and I'll be supporting the bill.
Other questions, comments? Senator Terrio.
Is it your intent to issue a zero fiscal note? Have the committee issue it?
If that's, maybe we could have you, yes, thank you. Put yourself on the record and give us a piece of advice about that.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm the Special Assistant to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We have drafted up a zero fiscal note already, and once the bill passes out in the proposed CS that are the way that you have spoken about, we will be issuing a zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Ms. Scavera. Further questions or comments on the bill? Hearing none, is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we move Senate Bill number 145, version backslash A, out of committee to the next committee of referral, along with accompanying zero fiscal note, or rather the fiscal note to be provided, and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. Another short recess. We're back on the record to now take up Senate Bill 18. We have a representative of the bill sponsor, Ms. Alberts. Ms. Alberts, welcome to the committee this afternoon. Please put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jane Alberts. I'm here for Senator Bundy for Senate Bill 18 on property foreclosures.
Ms. Alberts, just 1 second, just to get the committee up to speed, the current version in front of the committee, the working version, is backslash Victor. If we could have a motion to adopt the backslash Victor.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt version backslash Victor.
Without objection, it's adopted. Thank you, Ms. Alberts.
To refresh the committee, the last hearing we painstakingly went through 9 of the sections of the foreclosure bill. This bill was brought to us by request by Stefan Routh. He is an attorney with lengthy experience in the foreclosure world in the state and nationwide. And he walked us through 9 sections of Senate Bill 18, version V. We
Ms.
ended
Alberts,
up on section 10.
Thank you. And just one second to make sure. I'm not sure Senator Wilikowski has backslash Victor.
Can we take a brief at ease, Mr. Chair?
And we'll just take a brief recess. We're back on the record in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the current version before us is backslash N, Nero. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 18, backslash N, dated 4/25/07.
Without objection, that is our working document. Now, Ms. Alberts, you'll work us through. Do you want to work through where we left off, or do you want to begin at the beginning? It's up to you.
Well, if it's up to me, I'm going to say let's skip to Section 10 and have Stefan Routh go through the rest, but I didn't know what the will of the committee was in terms of, do you want to go through a little one-liner description on each section, or we want to cut to the chase and go to Section 10 and have Stefan continue the dissection of the sections?
Let's finish up, and then we'll take up the big differences between this version and the last one. So, Mr. Routh, are you on the line?
I am.
And you followed our movement now to the current version of the bill, backslash N, November, date of 4/25/07.
It was destined to happen because I made all my notes on Section V. So, but I'm being facetious. I have N in front of me, and I've got V in front of me as well.
Yeah, I couldn't hear you because the truck was going by. You've got the N version or the V version?
I have both versions in front of me, Mr. Chairman.
And we've adopted backslash N. Would you be able to take us through the end of that, beginning at Section 10?
I would.
Wonderful.
Section 10 is housekeeping, and the first part of that F deals with the priorities of distribution. This has been one area where there has been litigation, and the reason, I think, is that it's not clear in the statute what happens when the beneficiary bids less than the full debt that they're owed at a foreclosure auction. The best rule on that is that the beneficiary should get all the amounts due it, and then you go down the line of progression to who gets the next dollar after that. This clarifies that the beneficiary gets it until the beneficiary's paid, and if there's another second liener, they get it until they're paid, and then, you know, whenever the borrower is in line, the borrower gets the remainder. So more of a housekeeping. This is the way it's pretty much been arrived at through litigation, but we wanted to clarify it in the statute. G, Section 10G, gives a breathing space after a foreclosure auction. What this does is, again, it reduces litigation. Sometimes a sale is should not have been held, and the typical loser in this situation is the borrower, where there's been maybe a workout or loss mitigation efforts taken by a bank or a lender, and the borrower, the trustee, for some reason, does not get wind of it. It goes to sale. The borrower learns there's been a sale that shouldn't have been held and brings it to the trustee's attention. With this bill, the trustee can unwind the sale, put everybody back at status quo. Without this bill, then there's typically litigation to sort it out. So this just helps out typically borrowers so that you can unwind a sale if there's been a sale that should not have been held. Section 10 H talks about how you unwind the sale by handing the money back and how you re-notice the sale once you've unwound it. More, it's housekeeping in the aftermath of a sale that's unwound. Section 11 is more housekeeping. It allows, it allows attorneys for the beneficiaries to sign substitutions of trustee. It's just a good practice to allow that to happen that way, but the statute wasn't clear that you could do it, so this would allow it. Section 12 is a follow-on to Section 11 about the attorney executing documents on behalf of the beneficiary and the requirements. Section 13 is a new section that requires a bond by the trustee. It protects all parties to the transaction from unscrupulous trustees. There's no bonding requirement right now. To be a trustee and conduct foreclosures in Alaska now, all you have to do is be alive and breathing or otherwise a corporation or unnatural being. This would put a little more financial stability into the trustee corps so that there'll be some assurance that the people you're dealing with and are handling large sums of money are indeed fiscally responsible by obtaining a bond.
And Mr. Ralph, let me just jump in and ask you, how readily available are these surety bonds? And give me and the public who don't deal in this area very much an idea of how much one of these surety bonds might cost.
When I put together this language, I contacted some surety companies to see about availability and cost. And yes, they would be available. And the cost, I was led to believe, would be between $5,000 and $10,000 for a year's bond, basically, one bond that would be in place for 1 year.
So just so I'm clear, in order to participate as a trustee, your initial entry-level cost, at the minimum, is going to be between $5,000 and $10,000 a year.
Correct. Or if you're a title agent, then you're exempted from it.
And is this a provision that's out of a uniform act? Is this a standard provision?
It is not. It is the best practice, in my view. We found this in some other states, but it is not part of a uniform act. I don't think uniform acts have touched this area at all as far as the bonding of trustees.
And what, just let me ask you if there's any, I imagine some trusts are very large in the millions of dollars, but some trusts, I imagine, are not quite so large. I wonder if you're creating a situation where smaller trusts can't find trustees because it's difficult to afford the bond.
Well, yes. Keep in mind, this is not per foreclosure auction. This is per trustee.
Assuming a trustee is handling many trusts, the spread would be the cost would be spread out amongst those trusts.
Correct. And that is the practice that trustees tend to handle many of these things. It's an area of some specialization. But a person that had a deed of trust with a small balance, for example, they always have the option. Title agents love to do this type of work, and they'd be pleased to do it. And there's no bonding requirement whatsoever for them because they're licensed separately. there would always be an available trustee to use. And I wouldn't see people being driven out of the trustee market because of this bond. What I'd see is they'd have to show fiscal responsibility to continue in the market.
We can proceed. I'm going to flag that as an area that I'll probably spend a little time researching.
Okay. I think 13 was the last section.
It looks like the last section. So that brings us back, I guess, to the beginning of the document. If we can just explain where this backslash N is different from the document we've been working on previously. Ms. Albers.
Stefan, I think I can explain
sure.
These last four. If you go to section 2, line 23, all through these different versions, we had a typographical error that said published on at least 30 days, and it needs to say for. That was the first change. Page 4, line 12. The words except as provided in E of this section. Stefan might be able to address this, although it seems that this came out of a back and forth discussion between the AG's office on getting that line put into the bill.
Mr. Routh, any more light you can shed on the exception on line 12 of page 4?
No, Mr. Chairman, that was at the request of the Attorney General's office.
Well, we'll trust that they would never make an unreasonable request.
I think I'm okay with the change. I think it's a belt and suspenders change in my view.
All right, and Ms. Alberts, more?
Continuing on, page 5, line 28. It's a change that we missed. We made 3 months all throughout the bill into 90 days, and that was just some conforming language change.
All right.
And on page 9, line 28, that the person who obtained the bond also had to give notice to the department. And those were the four changes from version V to N.
Fantastic. So we've had an overview of the bill from stem to stern and now an explanation of the changes. Questions or comments for the representative of the bill sponsor or for Mr. Routh while he's on the line? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Alberts. Thank you very much, Mr. Routh. We'll set this bill aside for the time being.
Thank you.
And that brings us to Senate Bill 157 by Senator Dyson, who is here in the room with us today. Senator Dyson, nice to see you. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we've had a little confusion today on versions, so maybe you can tell us which version of the bill you'd like us to consider.
Backslash L, luck up 5107.
Then I'll need a brief recess. We're back on the record, and we have backslash Lima before us. If we could get a motion to adopt it.
Mr. Chairman, I move the backslash L as the working document before the committee.
Without objection, the document's before us. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. A federally funded task force was put together to work on human trafficking in Alaska, and that's made up of troopers, social service organization, FBI, APD, others, and I've met with them several times, and they have asked for some statute changes in Alaska law to facilitate their prosecuting of folks that are trafficking, but largely prostituting, and particularly children. So What you have before you is what we were able to get done in state statute that facilitates the recommendations from that task force. And I started out with a larger bill that did some more things, and we pared it down to addressing the criminal code. And if you'll follow with me, I'll kind of go through a little bit of what we've done in a sectional analysis here. In section one, page one, line seven, for the first time, as I understand it, in state law, this phrase puts a John law in our state law, which has not been there.
Just for clarity, making it equally criminal for both sides of the prostitution transaction.
Exactly right.
Thank you.
Yep. And then down on line 14, in our state, the age of consent to sexual conduct is 16. What we have done here is raise it to 18 in the case of prostituting a child. So you can have sex with a 17-year-old and it be legal in our state. But if it's an act of prostitution, they have to be more than 18, or you're guilty of having sexual relations with a child. And then you'll see on in sections 3, we're doing the same thing, bumping the age up from 16 to 18. And that's the one, it's a defense that, hey, I thought she was 20, you know. And she's got to have been, or he has got to have been 18, or you're equally guilty. And then what we've done is we've gone down through all the categories of prostitution and bumped them up one level. And the highest before was a B felony, and we bumped that up to an A felony. And then if it is you're prostituting a child, the penalty for that goes up to an unclassified felony. So we bumped that one up. If you're prostituting a child, it's an unclassified felony. Now, some confusion about it, but police officers that I've been working with have been concerned that prosecutors don't take misdemeanor and lower class prostitution really seriously, and they felt that they would if it is a felony. And the Department of Law is apparently comfortable with bumping these all up one notch. And then, and so that's what we've done. The section 7, that's basically running a house of prostitution. And that's now a C felony as opposed to being an A misdemeanor. And it also does the same thing on the age of the person. And then Mr. Luckup added a new fourth degree prostitution, which has not been in there. And you all who are in this profession probably understand. But it is the catch-all for catching somebody who is promoting prostitution, but it doesn't get up to a C or B level. And as I understand it, that will help us prosecute folks who are not know about it and may be facilitating it, but may not be getting a fee for service at that time. And I'm particularly interested because the police are telling me in Anchorage that, you know, there are hotel people that see 13-year-old girls going into some guy's room at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they know what's going on and are turning a blind eye. And it's my understanding that we may be able to get them on this. That's fine.
Actually, Senator Dyson, why don't we stop right there? And just, I've got a question for the Department of Law about the words institutes, aids, or facilitates. So maybe we can just jump to that and handle it while we're on this. The crime would be if a person engages in conduct that institutes, aids, or facilitates prostitution. And Mr. Zavodny, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And let me just ask you whether someone who delivers pizza to a prostitution, a place of prostitution, or whether a person who you know, sweeps the driveway, clears the snow, or hooks up a telephone service would be guilty of this crime.
The lawyer's answer is it depends. I mean, literally, if you're sweeping the driveway to aid in the commission of this offense so patrons can get there, the answer is yes. If you're delivering pizza because that's intend to aid in the commission of the offense by providing food for what's going on in there, the answer is yes. I think that's the case now. I mean, that wasn't the question you asked me. I think the answer is if you do something to facilitate the commission of the offense, if you're the bellhop, and not just the smiling bellhop, but the bellhop who's asked by somebody in the hotel, where can I find a prostitute, and the bellhop does something to facilitate that, I think they're guilty of promoting prostitution now. But I mean, this language is, if there are circumstances that maybe I'm not thinking about, this language may also capture that.
And just so we're clear, the mental element with respect to this provision of law would be knowing?
I'm hesitating because I don't know the answer to that. Typically, when somebody is charged with an aiding or abetting an offense, the culpable mental state is actually higher, that you have to intend that the underlying crime occur. So if, for example, somebody asked if they could borrow a gun from me, and I said sure and gave it to them, I don't commit a crime. But if I intended to help them in an armed robbery, I would have to have almost a higher culpable mental state. Sometimes you have to have a higher culpable mental state than the perpetrator. And so here, I think if it's the aiding and abetting type of situation, aid or facilitate, the court's going to, that language is not built into this statute. It's built into the regular culpability statute. So it may be, if it's not built in there, it may well be that it's knowingly. So I know you ask what seemed to me a simple question. I think ultimately the courts tell us the answer to that. The statutory construction answer is yes, I think you're right. It's knowingly.
So we probably don't have to insert the mental element here. You're telling me it's knowingly or higher. And so in the case of a person who's sweeping the driveway, you'd have to prove that he's not sweeping it to earn $5 because he lives in the neighborhood and he makes money sweeping driveways. You'd have to prove that he's sweeping it because he knows there's a big event that night and he's making sure the driveway's clear for business to be conducted inside the house of prostitution. Something along those lines.
If you don't use the word in the statute for conduct, it's knowingly and for conduct and recklessly for result, so it would be knowingly.
Thank you, Mr. Zabodny. I think the statute's fine the way it is.
Senator Wilkowski. Yeah, just to clarify, so it would by default be knowingly then?
If you don't put yes, it would be, the answer is yes.
And so in the case where someone is shoveling a driveway and they know that the person that owns the facility intends to have prostitutes there, they have committed the crime of aiding prostitution under this statute?
Through the chair, that's what I was trying to get at before. I don't really know the answer. If you knowingly aid or facilitate the conduct, then it would be. It's hard to figure out whether the person is knowingly aided. Well, I guess maybe it's not. I mean, you'd have to prove that they knew that they were clearing out the driveway so the patrons of the prostitute could go there.
Maybe I can clear this up by saying, is it fair to say, Mr. Zabodny, that in your view that you would be looking for business partners, business associates, and other people intimately connected with the operation in order to bring a prosecution?
That's fair to say. I think it's always going to be the case that the court's going to say mere presence at a crime is not sufficient to be guilty of the crime. There's going to have to be some other culpable mental state before a person's guilty of the crime.
Senator Wilkowski.
So in the example where there's a hotel and a person comes in late at night with someone that I guess they consider could be a prostitute, and they allow them to check into the room, have they committed a violation under this?
We have to show that they knew that the person was a prostitute.
Is that?
I would say,
Senator Dyson.
I'm sorry.
No, please.
Say if they're renting the room by the hour, and they see that same girl three or four times a night, that, good case.
Is that
Senator Wilkowski?
If I could, Mr. Chair, is that an objective standard or subjective standard on?
Reasonable person standard, wouldn't it be, Mr. Zabotny?
Right, and I'm objective. Trying to go through my mind. That's the jury's going to make a determination of the person intended in action. No, that's knowingly. That it knew or there was a substantial probability that the event existed, that there was an act of prostitution that was occurring or going to occur.
So objective. Objective standard.
It's a reasonable person's standard. Is that what a reasonable person, well, a jury looking at these facts, is that what a reasonable person would know or believe was going on?
Thank you.
I think that that helped the committee out quite a bit with that section. Thank you, Mr. Zabotny. We're on to section 9.
Okay. I bet they'll have more. Yeah, thank you. Section 9 just makes it very clear in the law that property used to aid or facilitate these violations can be seized. And then Section 10 just inserts promoting prostitution of children into that section of the code on sentencing.
Senator Wilkowski.
You just back up to Section 9. So if it is a hotel, let's say, and it's Hotel Captain Cook, I don't know, probably valued at several hundred million dollars, this says a violation of 135, the property shall be forfeited. So if they have a bell, let's say a clerk that checks in someone to the hotel, am I reading that correct? Is the hotel forfeited? I mean, is that possible? That seems pretty extreme.
Mr. Zabotny, is the Hotel Captain Cook at stake here?
generally, in the forfeiture provisions, I'd like to go back and look at the alcohol forfeiture provisions. But that was a big discussion in alcohol forfeiture, where Alaska Airlines kept claiming they were going to have a plane seized if one of their agents put a case of alcohol on going to a dry location. And I know we came to the conclusion, or we had language ultimately that made that not be the case. And I don't know that we have special language, or we just came to the conclusion that there has to be a nexus between the property that's being seized and that the person who owns the property has a property right in it, and they generally would not be subject to having their property forfeited unless, again, there was a certain culpable mental state, that is, they would act knowingly or recklessly. I mean, if under Senator Dyson's example, if the Hotel Captain Cook's renting the rooms out by the hour, they may well be subject to having their hotel seized. But if it's simply a clerk who's not acting at the behest of the hotel and they're acting beyond the scope of their duties as a hotel clerk, then the hotel's not going to be subject to forfeiture.
We'll flag this area for perhaps a little more attention as time goes on. But thank you for that explanation. Senator Dyson, back to you.
Yeah, and what we're really after here is the guys that are running a house of prostitution in their camper in our parks, at the cab drivers who are regularly facilitating this business, transporting John's, and or hand them a cell phone, said, here, the lady that loved to do business with you. All right, then we're over to section 11. And this is a section on fines, and this adds, and I believe it's for the first time now, that that prostitution, we can nail them with fines as well as jail sentences.
Thank you.
Section 12 is inserting another into the sentencing. So now what we're doing here is consistently saying that the penalty for prostituting a child is the same as for having molested or raped that child. And it's just a reiteration here of the sentencing, all the stuff that's in the sentencing codes, you can kind of see it in context. We had an additional section here, and the Child Protective Services, Juvenile Justice asked us to pull it, so we work on it, and it allows the state to take protective custody without arresting a child who's been prostituted, and I think that we've agreed to work on that and bring that back, and when we reconvene, and there, we just couldn't figure out how to do it really neatly, and it adds another layer where you, in essence, go before a magistrate or a judge and say, you know, this person is a danger to themselves and allows us to take protective custody without arresting them. We haven't got that nailed together, so we pulled it out of this bill.
I think I've seen some language, suggested language about that in a bill being worked on by Representative Dugan. Is that right? Have you worked at all with him on this?
A little
this?
Bit.
Okay. We do have one person signed up to testify. Actually, no, just to answer questions. Ms. Ashenbrenner's here to answer questions. Is there anybody else here in the room who would like to testify on Senate Bill 157? Anybody on the line that wants to testify about Senate Bill 157?
Mr. Chairman, I was asked, you know, to not line up a bunch of testimony.
I understand.
And certainly can if the committee requires it.
I don't need much convincing, but thank you. Other questions or comments for the bill sponsor while we have him in front of us?
Thank you,
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm just curious, if we pass this, where does this put us in line with other states? Do you know
Senator
that?
Senator Dyson, Mr. Zabotny?
I don't know, but I could get the lead person from the FBI who's been working this. Call you if you like.
Perhaps you can put him in contact with Senator Wilikowski.
Yep.
Very good. Other questions or comments? Hearing and seeing none, we'll hold this bill in the committee, and if there's nothing else to come before the Judiciary Committee, we will adjourn for the day.
When we-